followed me all the way from Payne's, did you? What a smart dog you are, eh?
Frisky thumped her tail happily. Naomi said,
I would hear this story of the sleepwalking king, Dennis, if you would tell it again.
So Dennis told his story, much as he told it to Pena and as I have told it to you, and they listened as spellbound as children hearing the tale of the talking wolf and the gammer's nightcap. CHAPTER 108 By the time he had finished, it was 7 o'clock. Outside, a dim gray glow had come over Delane. That clotted stormlight was as bright at 7 as it would be at noon, for the greatest storm of that winter, and perhaps the greatest in history, had come to Delane. The wind howled around the eaves of the castle like a tribe of banshees. Even down here the fugitives could hear it. Frisky raised her head and whined uneasily.
"What do we do now?"
Dennis asked. Ben, who had gone over Peter's brief note again and again, said,
"Until tonight, nothing. The castle's awake by now, and there's no way we could get out of here without being seen under any circumstances. We sleep, get our strength back, and tonight, before midnight—"
Ben spoke briefly. Naomi grinned. Dennis's eyes grew bright with excitement.
"Yes," Dennis said. "By the gods, you're a genius, Ben!" "Please, I wouldn't go that far," Naomi said,
but by then her grin was so broad it seemed in danger of splitting her head in two. She reached over, put her arms around Ben, and kissed him soundly. Ben turned an absolutely alarming shade of red. He looked as if he might be on the verge of bursting his brains, as they said in Delane in those long-ago days. I must tell you, though, that he also looked delighted.
"Will Frisky help us?"
Ben asked when he got his breath back. At the sound of her name, Frisky looked up again.
"Of course she will, but we'll need—"
They discussed this new plan for some time longer, and then Ben's lower face seemed to almost disappear in a great yawn. Naomi also looked tired out. They had been awake for over 24 hours by then, you will remember, and had come a great distance.
"Enough," Ben said. "It's time for sleep." "Hooray,"
Naomi said, beginning to arrange more napkins in a mattress for herself beside Frisky.
"My legs feel as if—"
Dennis cleared his throat politely.
"What is it?"
Ben asked. Dennis looked at their packs, Ben's big one, Naomi's slightly smaller one.
"I don't suppose you've got, anything to eat in there, do you?"
Impatiently, Naomi said,
"Of course we do. What do you think—"
Then she remembered that Dennis had left Payne's farmhouse 6 days ago, and that the butler had been skulking and hiding ever since. He had a pallid, undernourished look, and his face was too narrow and too bony.
"Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. We're idiots. When did you eat last?"
Dennis thought about this.
"I can't remember exactly," he said, "but the last sit-down meal I had was my lunch a week ago." "Why didn't you say so first thing, you dolt?"
Ben exclaimed.
"I guess because I was so excited to see you,"
Dennis said and grinned, as he watched the two of them open their packs and begin rooting through the remainder of their supplies. His stomach gurgled noisily, saliva squirted into his mouth. Then a thought struck him.
"You didn't bring any turnips, did you?"
Naomi turned to look at him, puzzled.
"Turnips? I don't have any, do you, Ben?"
"No."
A gentle and supremely happy smile spread across Dennis's face.
"Good,"
he said. 109. That was a mighty storm indeed, and it's still told of in Delane today. 5 feet of new snow had fallen by the time an early, howling dark came down on the castle keep. 5 feet of new snow in one day is mighty enough, but the wind made drifts that were much, much bigger. By the time dark fell, the wind was no longer blowing a four-scale, it was blowing a hurricane. In places along the castle walls, snow was piled 25 feet deep and covered the windows of not just first and second floors, but the third-floor windows as well. You might think this would have been good for Peter's escape plans, and it might have been if the needle hadn't stood all alone in the plaza, but it did, and here the wind blew its hardest. A strong man couldn't have stood against that wind. He would have been sent rolling head over heels until he crashed against the first stone wall on the far side of the plaza, and the wind had another effect as well. It was like a giant broom. As fast as the snow fell, the wind blew it out of the plaza. By dark there were huge drifts piled against the castle and clogging most of the alleys on the west side of the castle keep, but the plaza itself was clean as a whistle. There were only the frozen cobbles waiting to break Peter's bones if his rope should break. And I must tell you now that Peter's rope was bound to break. When he tested it, it had held his weight, but there was one fact about that mystic thing called breaking strain that Peter didn't know. Joseph hadn't known either. The ox drivers knew it, though, and if Peter had asked them, they would have told him an old axiom, one known to sailors, loggers, seamstresses, and anyone else who works with thread or rope. The longer the cord, the sooner the break. Peter's short test rope had held him. The rope to which he meant to entrust his life, the very thin rope, was about 265 feet long. It was bound to break, I tell you, and the cobbles below waited to catch him and break his bones and bleed away his life. 110. There were many disasters and near disasters on that long, stormy day, just as there were many acts of heroism, some successful and some doomed to failure. Some farmhouses in the inner baronies blew over, as the houses of the indolent pigs were blown over by the wolf's hungry breath in the old story. Some of those who were thus rendered homeless managed to work their way across the white wastes to the castle keep, roped together for safety. Others wandered off the Delane Great Road and into the whiteness where they were lost. Their frozen, wolf-gnawed bodies wouldn't be found until the spring. But by 7 that evening the snow had finally begun to abate a little, and the wind to fall. The excitement was ending, and the castle went to bed early. There was little else to do. Fires were banked, children tucked in, last cups of field tea drunk, prayers said. One by one the lights went out. The crier called in his loudest voice, but the wind still tore his voice out of his mouth at 8 o'clock, and again at 9. It was not until 10 that he could be heard again, and by then most people were asleep. Thomas was also asleep, but his sleep was not easy. There was no Dennis to stay with him and comfort him this night. Dennis was still home ill. Thomas had thought several times of sending a page to check on him, or even to go himself. He liked Dennis very much, but something always seemed to come up. Papers to sign, petitions to hear, and, of course, bottles of wine to be drunk. Thomas hoped Flagg would come and give him a powder to help him sleep. But ever since Flagg's useless trip into the north, the magician had been strange and distant. It was as if Flagg knew there was something wrong but could not quite tell what it was. Thomas hoped the magician would come but hadn't dared to summon him. As always, the shrieking wind reminded Thomas of the night his father died, and he feared he would have a hard time getting to sleep, and that once he was asleep, horrible nightmares might come, dreams in which his father would scream and rant and finally burst into flames. So Thomas did what he had grown accustomed to doing. He spent the day with a glass of wine always in his hand, and if I told you how many bottles of wine this mere boy consumed before he finally went to bed at 10 o'clock, you probably wouldn't believe me, so I won't say, but it was a lot. Lying there miserably on his sofa, wishing that Dennis was in his accustomed place on the hearth, Thomas thought, "My head aches and my stomach feels sick. Is being king worth all this? I wonder." You might wonder, too. But before Thomas himself could wonder any more, he fell heavily asleep. He slept for almost an hour, and then he rose and walked. Out the door he went and down the halls, ghostly in his long white nightshirt. This night a late-going maid with an armload of sheets saw him, and he looked so much like old King Roland that the maid dropped her sheets and fled, screaming. Thomas's darkly dreaming mind heard her screams and thought they were his father's. He walked on, turning into the less-used corridor. He paused halfway down and pushed the secret stone. He went into the passageway, closed the door behind him, and walked to the end of the corridor. He pushed aside the panels which were behind Niner's glass eyes, and though he was still asleep, he pushed his face up to the holes, as if looking into his dead father's sitting room. And here we will leave the unfortunate boy for a while, with the smell of wine surrounding him and tears of regret running from his sleeping eyes and down his cheeks. He was sometimes a cruel boy, often a sad boy, this pretend king, and he had almost always been a weak boy. But even now I must tell you that I do not believe he was ever really a bad boy. If you hate him because of the things he did, and the things he allowed to be done, I will understand. But if you do not pity him a little as well, I will be surprised. 111. At 11:15 on that momentous night, the storm breathed its last gasp. A tremendous cold gust of wind swept down on the castle. It ran in excess of 100 miles an hour. It tore the thinning clouds overhead apart like the swipe of a great hand. Cold, watery moonlight shone through. In the third eastern alley was a squat stone tower called the Church of the Great Gods. It had stood there since time out of mind. Many people worshipped there, but it was empty now. A good thing, too. The tower was not very tall, nowhere near the height of the needle, but it nevertheless stood high above the neighboring buildings in the third eastern alley, and all day long it had been punished by the unbroken force of the storm wind. This final gust was too much for it. The top 30 feet, all stone, simply blew off as a hat might fly off a scarecrow in a high gale. Part landed in the alley, part hit the neighboring buildings. There was a tremendous crash. Most of the populace of the castle keep, wearied by the excitement of the storm and already sleeping deeply, took no mind of the fall of the Church of the Great Gods, although they would wonder greatly over the snow-covered wreckage in the morning. Most simply muttered, turned over, and went back to sleep. Some guards of the watch, those not too drunk to care, heard it, of course, and ran to see what had happened. Other than by these few, the fall of the tower went mostly unremarked when it happened, but there were a few others who heard it, and by now you know them all. Ben, Dennis, and Naomi, who were getting ready for their attempt to rescue the rightful king, heard it in the napkin storeroom and looked around at each other with wide eyes.
"Never mind," Ben said after a moment. "I don't know what it was, but it doesn't matter. Let's get on with it."
Beeson and the lesser warders, all of them drunk, didn't hear the Church of the Great Gods fall down, but Peter did. He was sitting on the floor of his bedroom, carefully pulling his woven rope through his fingers, looking anxiously for weak points. He raised his head at the snow-muted thunder of falling stones and went rapidly to the window. He could see nothing. Whatever had fallen was on the needle's far side. After several considering moments, he went back to his rope. Midnight was close now, and he had come to much the same conclusion as his friend Ben. It didn't matter. The dice had been thrown. Now he must go on. Deep in the darkness of the secret passage, Thomas heard the muffled thunder thud of the falling tower and woke up. He heard the muffled barking of dogs below him and realized in horror where he was. And one other who had been sleeping lightly and dreaming troubled dreams awoke at the fall of the tower. He woke even though he was deep in the bowels of the castle.
"Disaster!"
one of the parrot's two heads screamed.
"Fire, flood, and escape!"
the other screamed. Flag had awakened. I have told you that evil is sometimes strangely blind, and so it is. Sometimes evil is lulled with no reason and sleeps. But now Flag had awakened. 112. Flag had come back from his trip into the north with a bit of a fever, a heavy cold, and a troubled mind. Something wrong, something wrong. The very stones of the castle seemed to whisper it to him, but Flag was damned if he knew what it was. All he knew for sure was that unknown something wrong had sharp teeth. It felt like a ferret running around in his brain, taking a bite here and a bite there. He knew exactly when that animal had begun to run and gnaw while he was coming back from the fruitless expedition in search of the rebels, because the rebels should have been there. They hadn't been, and Flag hated to be fooled. Worse, he hated feeling that he might have made a mistake. If he had made a mistake about where the rebels were to be found, then perhaps he had made mistakes about other things. What other things? He didn't know. But his dreams were bad. That small, bad-tempered animal ran around in his head, worrying him, insisting that he had forgotten things, that other things were going on behind his back. It raced, it gnawed, it ruined his sleep. Flag had medicines that would rid him of his cold, but none that would touch that growing ferret in his brain. What could possibly be wrong? He asked himself this question over and over again, and in truth it seemed, on the surface at least, that nothing could be. For many centuries, the old dark chaos inside him had hated the love and light and order of Delane, and he had worked hard to destroy all that, to knock it down as that last cold gust of storm had knocked down the Church of the Great Gods. Always something had interfered with his plans, a Kylo the Good, a Sasha, someone, something. But now he saw no possible interference, no matter where he looked. Thomas was totally his creature. If Flagg had told him to step off the highest parapet of the castle, the fool would want to know only at which o'clock he should do it. The farmers were groaning under the weight of the killing taxes Flagg had persuaded Thomas to impose. Yosef had told Peter there was a breaking strain on people as well as on ropes and chains, and so there is. The farmers and the merchants of Delane had nearly reached theirs. The rope by which the great blocks of taxes are attached to any citizenry is simple loyalty. Loyalty to king, to country, to government. Flagg knew that if he made the tax blocks big enough, all the ropes would snap and the stupid oxen, for that was really how he saw the people of Delane, would stampede, knocking down everything in their path. The first of the oxen had already broken free and had gathered in the north. They called themselves exiles now, but Flagg knew they would call themselves rebels soon enough. Pena had been driven away, and Peter was locked in the needle. So what could be wrong? Nothing! Damn it, nothing! But the ferret ran and squirmed and gnawed and twisted. Many times over the last 3 or 4 weeks he had awakened in a cold sweat, not because of his recurring fever, but because he had had some horrible dream. What was the substance of this dream? He could never remember. He only knew that he woke from it with his left hand pressed to his left eye, as if he had been wounded there, and that eye would burn, although he could find nothing wrong with it. 113. On this night, Flagg awoke with his dream fresh in his mind because he was awakened before it was over. It was, of course, the fall of the Church of the Great Gods which woke him.
Huh?
Flagg cried, sitting bolt upright in his chair. His eyes were wide and staring, his white cheeks damp and shiny with sweat.
Disaster!
One of the parrot's heads screamed.
Fire! Flood! And escape!
The other screamed. Escape, Flagg thought. Yes, that's what's been on my mind all this time, and that's what's been gnawing at me. He looked down at his hands and saw that they were trembling. This infuriated him, and he sprang out of his chair.
He means to escape,
he muttered, running his hands through his hair.
He means to try, anyway. But how? How? What's his plan? Who helped him? They'll pay with their heads, I promise that. And they won't come off all in one chop. No, they'll come off an inch. A half inch. A quarter inch at a time. They'll be driven insane with the agony long before they die.
Insane!
One of the parrot heads shrieked.
Agony!
The other shrieked back.
Will you shut up and let me think?
Flagg howled. He seized a jar filled with murky brown fluid from a nearby table and threw it at the parrot's cage. It struck and shattered. There was a flash of bright, heatless light. The parrot's two heads squawked in terror. It fell off its perch and lay stunned at the bottom of its cage until morning. Flagg began to pace rapidly back and forth. His teeth were bared. His hands worked together restlessly, the fingers of one warring with the fingers of the other. His boots struck up greenish sparks from the nitre-caked stones of his laboratory floor. These sparks smelled like summer lightning.
How? When? Who helped?
He could not remember. Already the dream was fading, but...
I have to know,
he whispered.
I have to know.
Because it would be soon. He sensed that much. It would be very, very soon. He found his keyring and opened the bottom drawer of his desk. He took out a box made of finely carved ironwood, opened it, and drew out a leather bag. He opened the bag's drawstring top and carefully took out a chunk of rock that seemed to glow with its own inner light. This rock was as milky as an old man's blind eye. It looked like a piece of soapstone, but was in fact a crystal. Flag's magic crystal. He circled his room, turning down the lamps and capping the candles. Soon his apartment was in absolute darkness. Dark or not, Flag returned to his desk with quick confidence, passing easily around objects that you or I would have barked our shins on or fallen over. The dark was nothing to the king's magician. He liked the dark, and he could see in it like a cat. He sat down and touched the stone. He slipped his palms down its sides, feeling its ragged edges and angles.
"Show me,"
he murmured.
"This is my command."
At first, nothing. Then, little by little, the crystal began to glow from within. There was only a tiny light at first, diffuse and pallid. Flag touched the crystal again, this time with the tips of his fingers. It had grown warm.
"Show me, Peter. This is my command. Show me the whelp that dares put himself in my way, and show me what he plans to do."
The light grew brighter, brighter, brighter. Eyes glittering, cruel, thin lips parted to show his teeth. Flag bent over his crystal. Now Peter, Ben, Dennis, and Naomi would have recognized their dream, and they would have recognized the glow which lit the magician's face, the glow which was not a candle. The crystal's milky cast suddenly disappeared, drawing into the brightening glow. Now Flag could see into its heart. His eyes widened, then narrowed in bewilderment. It was Sasha, very pregnant, sitting at a little boy's bed. The little boy was holding a slate. On it were written two words, God and dog. Impatiently, Flag passed his hands over the crystal, which now gave off waves of heat.
"Show me what I need to know. This is my command."
The crystal cleared again. It was Peter, playing with his dead mother's dollhouse, pretending the house and the family inside were being attacked by Indians, or dragons, or some foolish thing. The old king stood in the corner, watching his son, wanting to join in.
"Bah!"
Flag cried, waving his hands over the crystal again.
"Why do you show me these old, meaningless stories? I need to know how he plans to escape, and when. Now show me. This is my command."
The crystal had grown hotter and hotter. If he did not allow it to go dark soon, it would split apart forever, Flag knew, and magic crystals were not easy to come by. It had taken 30 years of searching to find this one, but he would see it broken into a billion pieces before he gave up.
"This is my command,"
he repeated again, and for the third time, the milkiness of the crystal drew inward. Flag bent over it until its heat made his eyes water and gush tears. He slitted them, and then, in spite of the heat, they flew open wide in shock and fury. It was Peter. Peter was slowly descending the side of the needle. Surely this was some treacherous magic, because, although he was making hand-over-hand motions, there was no rope to be seen. Or was there? Flag waved a hand in front of his face, dissipating the heat for a moment. A rope? Not exactly, but there was something. Something as gossamer as a strand of spiderweb, and yet it bore his weight.
"Peter."
Flag breathed, and at the sound of his voice the tiny figure looked around. Flag blew on the crystal, and its bright, wavering light went out. He saw its afterglow in front of his eyes as he sat in the dark. Peter. Escaping. When? It had been night in the crystal, and Flag had seen errant, gritty sheaves of snow blowing past the tiny figure, working its way down the rounded wall. Was it to be later tonight? Tomorrow night? Sometime next week? Or— Flag pushed back from his desk and stood up with a lurch, his eyes filled with fire as he looked around his dark and stinking basement rooms. Or had it happened already?
"Enough," he breathed. "By all the gods that ever were and ever will be, this is enough."
He strode across the darkened room and seized a huge weapon that hung on the wall. It was clumsy, but he held it with ease and familiarity. Familiar with it? Yes, of course he was. He had swung it many times when he had lived here and done business as Bill Hinch, the most feared executioner Delane had ever known. This terrible blade had bitten through hundreds of necks. Above the blades, which were of twice-forged Anduin steel, was Flagg's own modification, a spiked iron ball. Each spike had been tipped with poison.
Enough!
Flagg screamed again in a fury of rage and frustration and fear. The two-headed parrot, even in the depths of its unconsciousness, moaned at that sound. Flagg pulled his cloak from the hook by the door, swept it over his shoulders, and fastened the clasp, a hammered silver scarab beetle at his throat. It was enough. This time his plans would not be thwarted, certainly not by one hateful boy. Roland was dead, Pena unbenched, the nobles driven into exile. There was no one to raise an outcry over one dead prince, especially one who had murdered his own father. If you have not escaped, my fine prince, you never will, and something tells me you're still in the coop. But part of you will leave tonight, I promise you that. That part I intend to carry out by the hair. As he strode down the corridor toward the dungeon gate, Flagg began to laugh, a sound which would have given a stone statue bad dreams. 114. Flagg's intuition was right. Peter had finished going over his rope of twisted linen fibers, but he was still in his tower room, awaiting the crier's announcement of midnight, when Flagg burst out of the dungeon gate and began to cross the Plaza of the Needle. The Church of the Great Gods had fallen at 11:15. It was 12:15 when the crystal showed Flagg what he wanted to know. And perhaps you'll agree with my idea that it tried to show him the truth in two other ways at first, and when Flagg started across the plaza it was still lacking 10 minutes of midnight. The dungeon gate was on the northeast side of the Needle. On the southwest side was a little castle entrance known as the Peddler's Gate. A straight diagonal line could have been drawn between the dungeon gate and the Peddler's Gate. At the exact midpoint of that line was the Needle itself, of course. At almost the same time that Flagg came out of the dungeon gate, Ben, Naomi, Dennis, and Frisky came out of the Peddler's Gate. They approached each other without knowing it. The Needle was between them, but the wind had dropped, and Ben's party should have heard the clang rasp of Flagg's boot heels against the cobbles. Flagg should have heard the faint squeak of an ungreased wheel, but all of them, including Frisky, who was back to her old job of pulling again, were lost in their own thoughts. Ben and his party reached the Needle first. "Now," Ben began, and at that moment, from the other side, less than 40 paces around the outside perimeter from where they now stood, Flagg began to hammer on the triple-bolted warder's door.
"Open!"
Flagg screamed.
"Open in the name of the king!"
"What?"
Dennis began, and then Naomi clamped a hand like steel over his mouth and looked at Ben with frightened eyes. 115. The voice came spiraling up to Peter on the cold post-storm air. It was faint, that voice, but perfectly clear.
"Open in the name of the king!"
"Open in the name of hell, you mean," Peter thought. The good, brave boy had become a good, brave man, but when he heard that hoarse voice and remembered that narrow, white face and those reddish eyes, always shadowed by the hood of his robe, Peter's bones turned to ice and his stomach to fire. His mouth went as dry as a wood chip. His tongue stuck to the roof of his mouth. His hair stood on end. If someone has ever told you that being good and being brave means you will never be afraid, what that someone told you is not so. At that moment, Peter had never been so afraid in his whole life.
"It's Flagg, and he's come for me."
Peter got up, and for a moment he thought he was going to simply fall over as his legs buckled under him. Doom was down there, hammering at the warder's door to be let in.
"Open up! On your feet, you lousy, drunken buggers! Beeson, you son of a sot!"
"Don't hurry," Peter told himself. "If you hurry, you'll make a mistake and do his work for him. No one's come to let him in yet. Beeson's drunk. He was tiddly at supper and probably paralyzed by the time he got to bed. Flagg hasn't a key or he wouldn't be wasting time knocking. So, one step at a time, just as you planned it. He's got to get in and then climb those stairs, all 300 of them. You may beat him yet."
He went into his bedroom and pulled out the rough iron cotter pins that held the crude bed frame together. The bed collapsed. Peter grabbed one of the iron side bars and carried it back into the sitting room. He had measured this bar carefully and knew it was wider than his window, and while its outer surface was rusted, he thought it was strong yet through the middle. It had better be, he thought. It would be a bitter joke indeed if my rope held but my anchor broke. He looked out briefly. He could see no one now, but he had observed three figures crossing the plaza toward the needle shortly before Flagg's wild pounding had begun. Dennis had recruited friends then. Had one of them been Ben? Peter hoped so, but did not dare to really believe it. Who was the third, and why the wagon? They were questions he had no time for now.
Oh, you dogs! Open this door! Open it in the king's name! Open it in the name of Flagg! Open the door! Open!
In the stillness of almost midnight, Peter heard the rattle thud of the wrist-thick iron bolts far below being drawn back. He supposed the door opened, but he didn't hear that. Silence. And then a gurgling, choked scream. 116. The unfortunate lesser warder who finally answered Flagg's summons lived less than 4 seconds after drawing the third bolt on the warder's door. He caught a nightmare glimpse of a white face, glaring red eyes, and a black cloak that blew backward in the dying breeze like the wings of a raven. He screamed. Then the air was filled with a dry whooshing sound. The lesser warder, who was still half-drunk, looked up just as Flagg's battle-axe split his head in two.
Next time someone knocks in the name of the king, bestir yourselves and you won't have a mess to clean up in the morning!
Flagg bellowed. Then, laughing wildly, he kicked aside the body and strode up the corridor toward the stairs. Things were still all right. He had awakened to the danger in time. He knew it. He felt it. He opened a door on the right and stepped into the main corridor leading away from the courtroom where Anders Pena had once dispensed justice. At the end of that corridor, the stairs began. He looked up, grinning his dreadful shark-like grin.
"Here I come, Peter!"
he cried happily, his voice echoing and rebounding, spiraling up and up and up to where Peter stood preparing to tie his thin rope to the bar he had taken from the bed.
"Here I come, dear Peter, to do what I should have done a long, long time ago!"
Flagg's grin broadened, and now he looked terrible indeed. He looked like a demon which might have climbed lately from some reeking pit in the earth. He raised the executioner's axe. Drops of the slain warder's blood fell onto his face and ran down his cheeks like tears.
"Here I come, dear Peter, to chop off your head!"
Flagg screamed and began to run up the stairs. 1, 3, 6, 10. 117. Peter's shaking hands went wrong somehow. A knot he had made easily 1,000 times before now fell apart and he had to start over again.
"Don't let him scare you."
That was idiotic. He was scared, all right. Scared green. Thomas would have been astounded to know that Peter had always been frightened of Flagg. Peter had just hid it better.
"If he's going to kill you, make him do it. Don't do it for him."
The thought came from inside his own head, but it sounded like his mother's voice. Peter's hand steadied a bit, and he began to knot the end of his rope to his anchor again. 118.
"I'll carry your head on my saddle horn for 1,000 years!
Flagg screamed, up and up, around and around.
"Oh, what a pretty trophy you'll make!"
20, 30, 40. His boot heel struck green fire from the stones. His eyes glared. His grin was poison.
"Here I come!
Seventy, 230 steps to go. 119. If you have ever awakened in a strange place in the middle of the night, you'll know that just to be alone in the dark can be frightening enough. Now, try to imagine waking in a secret passage, looking through concealed eye holes into the room where you saw your own father murdered. Thomas shrieked. No one heard him, unless the dogs below did, and I doubt that. They were all deaf and making too much noise themselves. Now, there was an idea about sleepwalking in Delane, one that has also been commonly held as the truth in our world. This idea is that if a sleepwalker wakes up before returning to his or her bed, he or she will go mad. Thomas might have heard this tale. If so, he could attest that it wasn't true at all. He'd had a bad scare, and he had screamed, but he had not come even close to going mad. In fact, his initial fright passed rather quickly, more quickly than some of you might think, and he looked back into the peepholes again. This may strike some of you as strange, but you have to remember that, before the terrible night when Flagg had come with his own glass of wine after Peter left, Thomas had spent some pleasant times in this dark passageway. The pleasantness had a sour undertone of guilt, but he had also felt close to his father. Now, being back here, he felt a queer sense of nostalgia. He saw that the room had hardly changed at all. The stuffed heads were still there. Bonesy the elk, Craker the lynx, Snapper the great white bear from the north, and of course Niner the dragon, which he now looked through, with Roland's bow and the arrow Foehammer mounted above it. Bonesy, Craker, Snapper, Niner. I remember all their names, Thomas thought with some wonder. And I remember you, Dad. I wish you were alive now and that Peter was free, even if it meant no one even knew I was alive. At least I could sleep at night. Some of the furniture had been covered with white dust sheets, but most had not. The fireplace was cold and dark, but a fire had been laid. Thomas saw with mounting wonder that even his father's old robe was still there, hung in its accustomed place on the hook by the bathroom door. The fireplace was cold, but it wanted only a match struck and held to the kindling to bring it alive, roaring and warm. The room wanted only his father to do the same for it. Suddenly Thomas became aware of a strange, almost eerie desire in himself. He wanted to go into that room. He wanted to light the fire. He wanted to put on his father's robe. He wanted to drink a glass of his father's mead. He would drink it, even if it had gone bad and bitter. He thought he might be able to sleep in there. A wan, tired smile dawned on the boy's face, and he decided to do it. He wasn't even afraid of his father's ghost. He almost hoped it would come. If it did, he could tell his father something. He could tell his father he was sorry. 120.
Coming, Peter!
Flagg shrieked, grinning. He smelled like blood and doom. His eyes were deadly fire. The headsman's axe swished and whickered, and the last few drops of blood flew from the blade and splashed on the walls.
Coming now! Coming for your head!
Up and around, higher and higher, he was a devil with murder on his mind. 100. 125. 121.
Faster! Ben Stodd panted to Dennis and Naomi. The temperature had begun to fall again, but all three of them were sweating. Some of the sweat came from exertion. They were working very hard, but much of their sweat had been caused by fear. They could hear Flagg shrieking. Even Frisky, with her brave heart, felt afraid. She had withdrawn a little and huddled on her haunches, whimpering.
122.
Coming, you little whelp!
Closer now, his voice was flatter, with less echo.
Coming to do what I should have done a long time ago!
The twin blades swished and whickered. 123. This time the knot held.
Gods help me,
Peter thought, and looked back once more toward the sound of Flagg's rising, shrieking voice.
Gods, help me now.
Peter threw one leg out the window. Now he sat astride the sill as if it were Peony's saddle, one leg on the stone floor of his sitting room, the other dangling over the drop. He held the heap of his rope and the iron bar from his bed in his lap. He tossed the rope out the window, watching as it fell. It tangled and bound up halfway down, and he had to spend more time shaking the rope like a fish line before it would drop free again. Then, uttering one final prayer, he grasped the iron bar and pulled it against the window. His rope hung down from the middle. Peter slipped the leg that was inside over the sill, twisted around at the waist, holding on to the bar for dear life. Now only his bottom was on the sill. He made a half turn so that the cold outer edge of the sill was pressed against his belly instead of his butt. His legs hung down. The iron bar was seated firmly across the window. Peter let go of it with his left hand and caught hold of his narrow napkin rope. For a moment he paused, battling his fear. Then he closed his eyes and let go of the bar with his right hand. His whole weight was on the rope now. He was committed. For better or worse, his life now depended on the napkins. Peter began to lower himself.
Coming!
200.
For your head!
250.
My dear prince!
275. 125. Ben, Dennis, and Naomi could see Peter, a dark man-shape against the curved wall of the needle, high above their heads, higher than even the bravest acrobat would dare to go.
"Faster," Ben panted, almost moaned. "For your lives! For his life!"
They went about emptying the cart even faster, but in truth all they could do was almost done. 126. Flag raced up the stairs, his hood falling back, his lank, dark hair flying off his waxy brow. Almost there now, almost there. 127. The wind was light now, but very cold. It blew against Peter's bare cheeks and bare hands, numbing them. Slowly, slowly he descended, moving with careful deliberation. He knew that if he let his descent get out of hand, he would fall. In front of him, the great mortared stone blocks rolled steadily upward. Very soon he came to feel that he was remaining still, and it was the needle itself which was moving. His breath came in tight gasps. Cold, dry snow rattled on his face. The rope was thin. If his hands grew much number, he wouldn't be able to feel it at all. How far had he come? He didn't dare look down and see. Above him, individual strands of thread, cunningly woven together as a woman might braid a rug, had begun to pop threads. Peter did not know this, which was probably just as well. The breaking strain had nearly been reached. 128.
"Faster, King Peter," Dennis whispered.
The three of them had finished emptying the cart. Now they could only watch. Peter had descended perhaps half of the distance.
"He's so high,"
Naomi moaned.
"If he falls..."
"If he falls, he'll be killed,"
Ben said with a flat and toneless finality that silenced them all. 129. Flag reached the top of the stairs and ran down the corridor, his chest heaving as he gasped for breath. Sweat stood out all over his face. His grin was huge, horrible. He put his great axe down and pulled the first of the three bolts on the door to Peter's quarters. He pulled the second and paused. It would not be smart to simply go rushing in. Oh, no, not smart at all. The caged bird might be trying to fly the coop right this moment, but he might also be standing to one side of the door, ready to brain Flag with something the moment he rushed in. When he opened the spy hole in the middle of the door and saw the bar from Peter's bed placed across the window, he understood everything and roared with rage.
"Not so easy as that, my young bird!"
howled Flag.
"Let's see how you fly with your rope caught, shall we?"
Flag yanked the third bolt and charged into Peter's room with his axe held high over his head. After one quick look out the window, his grin resurfaced. He decided not to cut the rope, after all. Down and down Peter went. His arm muscles trembled with exhaustion. His mouth was dry. He couldn't remember ever wanting a drink as badly as he did right now. It seemed that he had been on this rope for a very, very long time, and a queer certainty had stolen into his heart. He would never get the drink of water he wanted. He was meant to die after all, and that wasn't even the worst of it. He was going to die thirsty. Right now that seemed the worst of it. He still did not dare look down, but he felt a queer compulsion, every bit as strong as his brother's compulsion to go into their father's sitting room, to look up. He obeyed it, and some 200 feet above he saw Flagg's white, murderous face grinning down at him.
"Hello, my little bird!"
Flagg called down cheerfully.
"I've an axe, but I really don't think I'll need to use it after all. I've put it aside, see?"
And the magician held out his bare hands. All the strength was trying to run out of Peter's arms and hands. Just the sight of Flagg's hateful face had done that. He concentrated on holding on. He couldn't feel the thin rope at all anymore. He knew he still had it because he could see it coming out of his fists, but that was all. His breath rasped in and out of his throat in hot gasps. Now he looked down and saw the white, upturned circles of three faces. Those circles were very, very small. He was not 20 feet above the frozen cobbles, or even 40 feet. He was still 100 feet up, as high as the fourth floor of one of our buildings. He tried to move and found he could not. If he moved, he would fall. So he hung there against the side of the building. Cold, gritty snow blew in his face, and from the prison above, Flagg began to laugh. 131.
"Why doesn't he move?"
Naomi cried, digging one mittened hand into Ben's shoulder. Her eyes were fixed on Peter's twisting form. The way it hung there, slowly turning, made it look dreadfully like the body of a man who had been hanged.
"What's wrong with him?"
"I don't—"
Above them, Flagg's chilly laughter abruptly stopped.
"Who goes there?"
he called. His voice was like thunder, like doom.
"Answer me if you want to keep your heads! Who goes there?"
Frisky whined and shrank against Naomi's side.
"Oh, gods, now you've done it," Dennis said. "What do we do, Ben?"
"Wait," Ben said grimly. "And if the magician comes down, fight. We wait for what happens next. We—"
But that was all the waiting any of them had to do, for in the next few seconds, much— not all, but a great deal, was resolved. 132. Flagg had seen the thinness of Peter's rope, its whiteness, and in a trice he understood everything, from beginning to end, the napkins and the dollhouse as well. Peter's means of escape had been under his nose the whole time, and he had very nearly missed it, but he saw something else as well. Little pops of fiber where the strands were giving way, some 15 feet down the taut length of rope. Flagg could have turned the iron bar he was resting his hand on and sent Peter plummeting that way, with the anchor trailing after to perhaps bash his head in when he struck bottom. He could have swung the battle axe and parted the fragile rope, but he preferred to let matters take their course, and a moment after he had challenged the voices, matters did take their course. The rope's breaking strain was reached. It parted with a twang like a lute string that has been wound too far on its peg.
"Goodbye, birdie!"
Flagg cried happily, leaning far out to watch Peter's fall. He was laughing.
"Goodbye!"
Then his voice ceased and his eyes widened as they had when he looked into the crystal and saw the tiny figure descending the side of the needle. He opened his mouth and screamed with rage. That awful cry woke up more people in Delane than the fall of the tower. 133. Peter heard that twanging sound, felt the rope part. Cold wind rushed up past his face. He tried to steel himself for the crash, knowing it would come in less than a second. The pain, if he didn't die instantly, would be the worst. and that was when Peter struck the thick, deep drift of royal napkins which Frisky had hauled out of the castle and across the plaza in a stolen cart, the royal napkins which Ben, Dennis, and Naomi had worked so feverishly to pile up. The size of that pile, it looked like a whitewashed haystack, was never really known because Ben, Dennis, and Naomi all had different estimates on the subject. Perhaps Peter's own idea was the best, since he was the one who fell squarely into the middle of it. He believed that messy, lovely, life-saving pile of napkins must have been at least 20 feet high, and for all I know, he may have been right. He fell squarely into the middle, as I have said, making a crater. Then he fell over on his back and lay still. Far above, Ben heard Flag howl with rage, and he thought, "You don't need to do that. Everything's going to be just fine for you, magician. He has died anyway, in spite of all we could do." Then Peter sat up. He looked dazed, but very much alive. In spite of Flag, in spite of the fact that there might be guards of the watch racing toward them at that moment, Ben Stodd whooped. It was a sound of pure triumph. He grabbed Naomi and kissed her.
"Hurrah!"
Dennis cried, grinning dizzily.
"Hurrah for the king!"
Then Flag screeched again far above them, the sound of a devil bird cheated of its prey. The whooping, the kissing, and the hurrahing all stopped right then.
"You'll pay with your heads!"
Flag shrieked. He was insane with rage.
"You'll pay with your heads, all of you! Guards of the watch, to the needle! To the needle! The regicide has escaped! To the needle! Kill the murdering prince! Kill his gang! Kill them all!"
And in the castle that surrounded the plaza of the needle on all four sides, windows began to be lit, and from two sides came the sound of running feet and the clash of metal as swords were drawn. Flag shrieked hellishly from the top of the needle.
"Kill his gang! Kill them all!"
Peter tried to get up, floundered, and fell over again. Part of his mind was crying out urgently that he must get on his feet, that they must be away or they would be killed. But another part insisted that he was already dead, or severely wounded, and all of this was only a dream of his perishing mind. He seemed to have landed in a bed of the very napkins which had occupied so much of his mind over the last 5 years, and how could that be anything but a dream? Ben's strong hand gripped his upper arm, and he knew it was all real, all happening.
"Peter, are you all right? Are you really all right?"
"Not hurt a bit," Peter said. "We have to get away from here."
"My king!"
Dennis cried, falling on his knees before the dazed Peter and grinning the same dizzy, foolish grin.
"My oath of fealty forever! I swear my—"
"Swear later!" Peter cried, laughing in spite of himself, as Ben had pulled him to his feet, so Peter now pulled Dennis to his.
"Let's get out of here!" "Which gate?"
Ben asked. He knew, as Peter did himself, that Flag would already be on his way back down.
"They come from all sides by the sound."
In truth, Ben thought any direction would do for the battle which would surely come, and result in their eventual slaughter. But, dazed or not, Peter knew perfectly well where he wanted to go.
"The west gate," he said, "and quickly, run!"
The four of them ran, Frisky at their heels. 135. Still 50 yards from the west gate, Peter's band met a party of 7 sleepy, confused guards. Most of them had sheltered from the storm in one of the warm lower kitchens of the castle, drinking mead and exclaiming to one another that they would have something to tell their grandchildren about. They did not know the half of what they would have to tell their grandchildren about as it happened. Their leader was a man-boy of just 20 and only a goshawk, what we would call a corporal, I suppose. Still, he hadn't had anything to drink and was reasonably alert, and he was determined to do his duty.
"Halt in the name of the king!"
he called out as Peter's group closed with his slightly larger one. He tried to thunder this command, but a storyteller should tell as much of the truth as he can, and I must tell you that the goshawk's voice was more squeak than thunder. Peter was unarmed, of course, but Ben and Naomi both carried short swords, and Dennis had his rusty dagger. All three of them at once pushed in front of Peter. Ben's and Naomi's hands went to their hilts. Dennis had already pulled his dagger.
"Stop!"
Peter cried. His voice was thunder.
You must not draw.
Surprised, shocked even, Ben threw a glance at Peter. Peter stepped to the fore. He stood with his eyes flashing moonlight and his beard riffling in the light, chill-edged wind. He was dressed in the rough clothes of a prisoner, but his face was commanding and regal. "Halt in the name of the king, you say," Peter said. He stepped calmly toward the terrified goshawk until the two of them were almost chest to chest. Less than 6 inches separated them. The guard fell back a step in spite of his own drawn sword and the fact that Peter's hands were empty. "And yet I tell you, goshawk, I am the king." The guard licked his lips. He looked around at his men.
"But,"
he began,
"you—"
"What is your name?" Peter asked quietly. The goshawk gaped. He could have run Peter through in a second, but he only gaped helplessly, like a fish drawn from water.
"Your name, goshawk?"
"My lord, I mean, prisoner, you, I—"
The young soldier fumbled once more and then said helplessly,
"My name is Galen."
"And do you know who I am?"
"Yes," one of the others growled. "We know you, murderer."
"I did not murder my father," Peter said quietly. "It was the king's magician who did that. He is hot behind us now, and I advise you, very strongly I advise you, to ware of him. Soon he will trouble Delane no more. I promise this on my father's name, but for now you must let me pass." There was a long moment of silence. Galen held his sword up again as if to run Peter through. Peter did not flinch. He owed the gods a death. It was a debt he had owed ever since he had come a shrieking, naked baby from his mother's belly. It was a debt every man and woman in creation owed. If he was to pay that debt now, let it be so. But he was the rightful king, not a rebel, not a usurper, and he would not run or stand aside or let his friends hurt this lad. The sword wavered. Then Galen let it fall until the tip of the blade touched the frozen cobbles.
"Let him pass," he muttered. "Mayhap he murdered, mayhap he didn't. All I know is that it's royal muck, and I'll not step into it, lest I drown in a quicksand of kings and princes."
"You had a wise mother, goshawk,"
Ben Stad said grimly.
"Yes, let him pass,"
a second voice said unexpectedly.
"By gods, I'll not strike my blade at such. From the look of him, it would burn off my hand when it went in."
"You will be remembered," Peter said. He looked around at his friends. "Follow me now," he said, "and be quick. I know what I must have, and I know where to get it." At that moment, Flag burst from the base of the needle, and such a howl of rage and fury rose in the night that the young guards quailed before it. They backed up, turned, and ran, scattering to the four pegs of the compass. "Come on," Peter said. "Follow me. The west gate." 136. Flag ran as he had never run before. He sensed the oncoming ruin of all his plans now, at what was practically the last moment. It must not happen, and he knew as well as Peter where all of this must end. He passed the cowering guards without looking around. They sighed with relief, thinking he must not have seen them, but Flag did. He saw them all and marked each. After Peter died, their heads would decorate the tower walls for a year and a day, he thought. As for the brat in charge of their patrol, he would die 1,000 deaths in the dungeon first. He ran under the arch of the west gate and down the main western gallery into the castle itself. Sleepy folk, who had come out in their night clothes to see what all this row was about, cowered before his whitely burning face and fell aside, forking their first and last fingers at him to ward off evil. For now Flag looked like what Flag really was, a demon. He vaulted over the banister of the first staircase he came to, landed on his feet, the iron on his heels flashed green fire like the eyes of lynxes, and ran on toward Roland's apartments. 137.
"The locket," Peter panted to Dennis as they ran. "Do you still have the locket I threw down?"
Dennis clutched at his throat and found the golden heart. Peter's own blood dried on the tip, and nodded.
"Give it to me."
Dennis passed it to him as they ran. Peter did not put the chain over his neck, but looped it in his fist so that the heart bounced and spun as he ran, flashing red gold in the light of the wall sconces.
"Soon, my friends," Peter panted.